Hi, everyone. I wanted to start out today with a quick shout out to Matron Saint, a super chic maternity line that wants to revolutionize the way you dress as you embark on motherhood. Their clothes are simple, stylish, and comfortable. Use the code PYC20 when you check out for 20% off your order. Now I want to ask you, my listeners, for a shout out. Rate and review Yoga Birth Babies on iTunes or Stitcher, and follow PYC and Matron Saint on Instagram for your chance to win a $100 gift card from Matron Saint. Email a screenshot of your review and your handle to info@prenatalyogacenter.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I'm your host for Yoga Birth Babies. And today we're talking to Carrie Conti about understanding your child's brain and how that can actually help you be a better parent. And then if there's some time, we're going to start talking a little bit about slow parenting and what that even means. So first, let me tell you a little bit about Carrie. Carrie Conti, PhD, is an internationally recognized coach, author, speaker, and educator. Her work offers a new perspective on human development, parenting, family life, and being a healthy, happy, whole human being. She is the co-author of the Slow Family Living Movement and the co-author of Calms, A Guide to Soothing Your Baby. She's appeared on NBC's The Today Show, NPR, CBS Radio, and in many publications, including Time, Parenting, and the Boston Globe. She is currently enjoying her life as a luxury nomad, following the path that unfolds in front of her. To learn more about her, you can check her out at carrieconti.com. Hi, Carrie. Welcome. I'm so excited to talk to you about this.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Deb.
Absolutely. Your work really was kind of eye-opening. Even though I felt like I should have known some of this when I saw it, it really was a game changer. So let's just kind of get into what even inspired you to get into this line of work.
Well, my story is a little unique, and some of the people out there may have heard it, but I didn't get to this through parenting. I'm not even a parent. So my journey of all of this began in childhood, and I'm actually sitting in my childhood bedroom and recalling the story is kind of funny because I'm living with my mom right now because my dad passed away. But I was a little kid and we moved to I was always fascinated by babies and children. And so when we moved here to Suffern, New York, I got really excited because some neighbors had little ones, and I became the mother's helper. I was just enthralled with little humans. And I thought, oh, I'll be a pediatrician because then I can be around babies. And then I got to college and I'm like, oh, too much science. And so I went in the direction of psychology. And then I thought about midwifery. But my path really was all about more about evolution and trying to figure out what we need in the beginning of life to stay connected to our wholeness. Like I really operate from this paradigm that we're big beings in little bodies. And so what I did for my childhood and my teenhood and my early adulthood was study this. And then since my grad program in pre and perinatal psychology, I've been practicing this stuff with thousands of parents all over the world. So my quest is more about wholeness and evolving consciousness than it is about people just being good parents. And that's a byproduct, but that's not what got me, you know, my big being came here, I believe, to really explore this puzzle very deeply. And in a weird way, the fact that I didn't do it through parenting gives me a kind of a unique perspective, because I still can hold the perspective of the child a little differently than when you've crossed the bridge into parenting.
I actually really appreciate that. I started teaching prenatal yoga actually many years before I was a parent and went through the experience. Mm-hmm. So I do think having being more rested is definitely part of it, but having a different eye and perspective to the experience really lends a different lens. So yeah. I started watching, as I knew I was going to talk to you, I dove into your videos and all your articles, and I watched your TED Talk, and you beautifully explained how our understanding of human development has been changing. Can you go a little more into detail about the old paradigm versus the new paradigm in human development?
Sure. That's where I love to start because it really frames the conversation a little differently than when I just jump in. So, you know, conventional psychology and pediatrics and what we've sort of been led to believe over the last 300 years, which comes from a very mechanistic perspective, was that if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. And when that comes to human birth and parenting and human development, the idea was that because you didn't see what was going on in the womb, we didn't know what was going on in there until about 40 years ago when ultrasounds came into fashion, we didn't pay much attention to it. And so when a baby was born, that's when we started the clock of one, zero. And then a year later after the birth, that's one. And what that perspective really is suggesting is that nobody's there and that, you know, they're a blank slate, that you get a blank slate and you as the parent are having to fill up this person and make them a human and teach them good, making them good. And a lot of this mindset was really steeped in a lot of traditional religion around this idea that humans are not inherently good and that unless they subscribe to these views, you're not really, you know, that you have to make them who they are. Mm-hmm. And that's the old paradigm. I call that the world is flat paradigm. Now, what we've learned through attachment theory and my field of pre and perinatal psychology and all the psychoneurobiology that we're learning now gives us a much different perspective. And that new perspective, which I call the world is round perspective, is that you don't get a blank slate. You don't even get a baby. You get a person and they happen, they're conscious. They're the big being. They're fully alert and alive and aware. And they're very instrumental in creating the experience they're having. And they are in this tiny little body that has to develop. And it's the development that is what is going to allow them to express more of who they are and what they're here for. And so, yeah, so let me just say one more thing. So the new perspective really gives parents a different lens to see this tiny human through and also to see the development through.
So that's what you mean by the big being in the little body.
Yes. Like what I mean is that, yes, we are these physical bodies. We are physical beings, but we are also these spiritual, conscious, bigger beings that are just inhabiting these bodies or using these bodies or creating these bodies so that we can be here having these human experiences. But ultimately, the big beingness is never not there. So you don't get this in, you don't get a person who doesn't know anything. You get a person who can't express what they know, and it's through development that they learn how to operate the machine. And by operating the machine, they start to express languages and physical movements and creativity. And if you look through that lens and you say, I know you're in there, you might not be able to do the things that we do, but you're going to learn those really quickly. So how do I want to relate to you as the big being and take care of your little body until you can take care of it yourself in a way that creates respect and honor and reverence for the miraculous experience of humanness?
So how would that work with the communication that we have with babies? I mean, we should give them more
well, what
credit.
I like to... Yeah, exactly. Give them a lot more credit. So, you know, in my... both my academic studies, my PhD studies, and my just being a human on this planet studying something for 40 plus years, what I believe is you want to relate to them just as you would relate to any other person. You know, we don't think of grandparents who are, you know, 90 or 100 as an other. We just see them in a different phase of life. And if we could bring that same awareness of, okay, little tiny person, you can't speak the languages we speak yet, but I know you're in there. Mm-hmm. And so what I say is you have to hold both. It's a paradox. They are not capable of the stuff we do, and we do need to wipe their butts and help them get nourishment. But in the midst of that, we're doing a disservice if we're goo-goo-ga-ga-ing them or we're talking over them. So looking them in the eye, even at the moment of birth or even in the womb, not looking them in the eye in the womb, but saying to them, I know you're in there. I know you're you. I know you're a person, and I'm going to honor you and respect you just like I would honor and respect anybody else. And I'm going to snuggle you and eat you up because you're delicious. But I'm also going to not think you're somehow less than any other human, because in fact, you might actually be more than many of the humans, because you're coming with a bigger consciousness, because you're coming into this time and space of this reality of our world. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute complete sense, especially the coming in maybe more because they haven't been jarred or tarnished by some other thoughts.
Right. Yeah. There's a purity to the awareness and the expression of life.
So I want to talk. Again, I was totally geeking out on all your work, and I want to talk about if you can give a quick and simple overview of the triune brain. I like how you described it with your hand. So I don't know if you can do that over audio, but it made sense to me.
Sure,
what I can do is on the show notes, I can put up, if you don't mind, that sheet that you had on your website.
Yes, please do.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you want to link videos, that's fine too. I'm open to anything. Ooh, I just want people to get this.
Especially the drum video. And those are like drum video. We'll get to the drum video.
We'll get to the drum video. It's so fun. Okay. So this is perfect. So big being, little body, you know, they're conscious, they're aware. However, they do come in this little body, and the little body, specifically the brain, is very immature. And the reason for that is, one, they have to get out of the mom's body, so their brains can't get as big as they need to be to function the way we do. You know, we're not horses. We don't come out and fumble around for a few minutes and then start walking an hour or two later. We're very immature in our development when we arrive outside of the womb. And so one reason is because we have to get out and our brains can't, you know, we need to not be as big as we'll get in terms of our brain development. But the other is that we need to experience the world and the society and the culture and the family that we're going to need to survive in. And we want to wire for that. We don't want to pre-wire for languages, whether it's, you know, a verbal language or social languages or creative languages that we're not going to need to survive and express who we are in this particular time and space. Mm-hmm. So we come in with only about 10, 15, 20% at max of our brain wiring. And we wire from the bottom up. So if you were to think about your brain, you think about the brain stem, which is in your neck. And then you think about the middle brain, which is kind of in the depth of the cranium. And then you think about your neocortex, which is basically behind your forehead and your eyes. And if you think of those as the three main parts, there's a lot more to it, but for parenting purposes, this is plenty. So those three parts, we'll call it the brainstem or the reptile brain. We'll call it the limbic system or the mammal brain. And we'll call it the human brain or the neocortex. Those three parts all have very different functions. And the hindbrain, the reptile brain, the brainstem, is all about survival. So when a little one comes out of the womb, they're not using their human brain to say, hey, I'm tired and hungry, and this is really weird that I was just birthing, I just came out of somebody's body, and now I have to figure out all this stuff. All they're doing is taking in information through their senses about the environment and assessing, am I safe or am I not safe? And when they're safe, they're calm and quiet and they're rested and relaxed. But when the minute the alarm goes off of something new or something unknown or something that feels different in their body, that reptile brain, the fight or flight system, kicks in, and that's when they start crying or that's when they start moving their body in ways that are sort of expressing a flight response. And so when the little one arrives, that's all they've got. They're only pre-wired to express that safe or not safe. They're in there. There's the big being who's in there. But the wiring for expression is very limited in the sense that it's only to let their caregivers, the people around them, know, I feel safe or I feel unsafe. Please do something. Please help me. Please keep me safe. So then at about 6 weeks, ideally they've gotten that, you know, good enough care and they have people that they're starting to feel like, okay, well, when I get upset, this person is there and they communicate both through their words, but more importantly through their emotions, I'm okay, I'm safe. And then at about 6 weeks, as you know, your listeners know, that's when that middle brain kicks on and starts to develop and the neurons and the wiring starts to take place in that middle brain, which still isn't a verbal brain, but it's an emotional brain. And if you think about mammals, they connect emotionally. We may not understand the languages that they're communicating with, but we see a similarity in the sense that, you know when your dog is a little bit off and your dog knows when you're a little bit off and they might come a little closer and you know when your dog's excited and happy, but they're not looking at you going, wow, this was really fun. I'm so glad we went to the park. They're just moving and they're just emoting. And so humans do the same thing. So for that first year of life, when that little one is starting to, you know, become a member of the family and starting to explore the environment in a very contained way, they are communicating with that emotional brain. And then at about 9 months, 10 months, a year, they start operating with a little more skill in the neocortex, in their human brain. And when they're doing that, that's all the goodies. That's art and creativity and empathy and language. And that's the add-on. That's not the survival brain. That's not even the connection brain. That's just the creative expression and being a human in the world brain. And so what's important to understand about this is it's not a linear process. It's not like, okay, I wired up my reptile brain and now I feel safe all the time. I never have to use that. I wired up my limbic brain. I feel like I'm connected and I can emote. I never have to use that. It's actually the case that when we are resourced, when we have enough juice in our emotional cup, we can access the human brain part of ourselves. But as we get depleted, as the battery drains, we start to slip and we go into either our emotional brain, and that's when humans are whiny or cranky or chaotic, or, you know, you're looking at your phone a million times looking for something to make you feel good. That's because you've slipped into a mammal brain. Or it's when you're freaking out, that's when you've slipped into your reptile brain. It's fight or flight. You either freak out or you shut down or you want to run.
This makes so much sense.
Go ahead. Yeah, go.
This makes so much sense because I listen to this and I think, I look at myself, I'm like, oh, I do some of those things, or my husband, I think about my kids. So can you explain how or why it's so important for a parent to understand this, and then how that understanding can influence parenting? Because I actually used a little bit this morning and it worked.
Oh, yay. Oh, I'm so happy. Okay. So we're going to go back to old paradigm, new paradigm, so I can wind into this. So old paradigm, we didn't know this stuff. People didn't understand this. So when somebody would slip in their brain and whine or be cranky or have a meltdown in the grocery store, that was considered misbehavior. New paradigm, with this new understanding of the brain, really gives a new picture and helps us understand, oh, this person isn't misbehaving, which through this lens makes no sense at all, actually. They're stress behaving. And that's something I got from a teacher, Brian Post, who really illuminated that if you put on this new set of glasses and you recognize that because the little person doesn't come pre-wired and because of what it takes for them to wire and regulate and learn how to use this whole mechanism of an emotional system to be appropriate, quote unquote, in our society, you realize, wow, that's a lot of work. And sometimes you're going to be human and you're going to say please and thank you and you're going to get your shoes on really easily and you're going to be able to have fun conversations. But a lot of time, especially at home, because they're using a lot of those human goodies, the neural connections out there at school, at daycare, at different places where they're not as safe and secure, you as the parent are often going to get the more mammal brain, which is the whiny, the crispiness, the clingy, the saying no, the resisting, or you're going to get the full-on meltdown, which is either tantruming or saying I hate you or running off and not looking you in the eye. And that is a function of the brain state, not of the person. Does that make sense?
It makes so much sense. And so this morning, it's funny you mentioned the shoes. So this morning, and I'm trying to also incorporate the slow parenting, although I'm failing.
It's a practice. And if you live in New York, it's a double, triple, quadruple practice. So it's trying lots of grace around this one.
I was trying to get them out the door. I have two. I have a 3 and a 6-year-old. Mm-hmm. Trying to get them out the door. And it was about the shoes. Get your shoes mm-hmm. on. Plenty of time. I left plenty of time. Get your shoes on. So when they started to get, I can almost see them going from, we were having fun, we were talking, they were in their neocortex, and then it started, it was almost like they went downward. And instead of me getting more frustrated, which I will admit is my usual trigger, I stepped back and I'm like, okay, I need to ground and get calm and not fly off the handle, and they will likely gather themselves a little bit better instead of me just screaming at them to get out the door. And it worked.
Yes. Yay. Okay. Do you want to know why?
Yes.
Okay. And this is important. So yes, they're going to be, okay. So point number one, because of their phase of development, they are not locked in. They can't become human. We can take our human brain off and go more limbic or more reptile. And when you do that consciously, when you do catch your own revving and you do slow yourself down, what you're doing is you're bringing yourself back into a human state. And that's important because they're reading your brain state. They're hearing your words, but through the words, they're hearing where you are in your brain, and they can't be somewhere you're not because you're the regulator. So when you start getting revved up and frustrated and the old paradigm kicks in of like, I'm the parent, they should listen. This is what it's supposed to be like. I'm not going to let them win. You know, I mean, that's not literally going through your head, but that's old stuff that's in there mm-hmm. because of when we were parented. So when you can catch that and go, all right, slow down. If I want to speed up, I need to slow down. That's one of the lessons I got from grad school, which a professor would always say, if you want to speed up, slow down. When you change your brain state and catch yourself, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought I lost you. When you catch yourself, when you take that micro pause before just doing the thing that kicks on, which is get your shoes on. We got to go. I can't believe you guys. Ugh, you know, all that junk that we do, everybody does. When you catch that and you go, okay, here's these little people. They are growing. They may or may not want to rush off to school today. So I could either keep pushing and get into a power struggle, or I can slow down and take my human brain off, get a little more playful, get a little less words, more connection, slow it down and get playful and connect and try to, you know, once out of 50 times, if I can catch it and try something different and you see that it works, you realize, A, it doesn't take much more time than us just getting into a messy power struggle, but B, it feels a lot better to everybody involved when the parent takes responsibility for the fact that you're not going to be able to rationalize because they're not in that brain state with somebody who's only been on the planet 3 or 6 years of 100 mm-hmm. years.
So it's almost like, and my husband said this, like their ears are not working. Like, is that basically what's happening? Like they just can't.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. No, I mean, think about it. You are human. You're in your human brain and, you know, like this, we're having this lovely conversation. This is a human brain conversation. You and I are using our best human brain stuff right now. Mm-hmm. If you had gotten no sleep, which is possible, and you were harried or something yucky happened this morning, and you were trying to have this conversation, but you were not in that human brain state. You were stressed and you were in more of an emotional brain state. You would feel as if these words either weren't making sense or there were just far too many of them. So think about when you're really exhausted and you get home from work and you look at your partner and you go, oh, I'm exhausted. And if your partner says, well, you really should have got more sleep last night. And here's why you shouldn't be exhausted. And here's what you should be doing differently. You're like, yikes, that is not what I need. But if this person goes, oh, come here, let me give you a hug. that says to your limbic brain that you're in, that says to the brain state that you're in because you're overdone, you're safe, I'm with you, I hear you. And then that gets your human brain back online.
So as parents, when our kids are in that, the brain stem, and I want to get back mm-hmm. to the drum scenario in a minute, but when our kids are in that state,
yes.
And again, the trigger for most parents is like meeting them in that state. So you're saying that we need to not go to that state and try to quiet. Do we literally try to like get our arms around them and hug them, or do we just try to quiet ourselves?
Quieting yourself first, always, because they're not, because you could grab them and go, "Ooh, calm down, everything's fine." But if they're not feeling that, if you're already slipping in your brain, which can happen in a millisecond, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, like I said, if you can catch this 1 out of 50 times, 1 out of 60 times, you're winning. Like, this is long-term investing in a practice. This is not going to be effortless if it's not what you were given as a baby, because your wiring is too triggery because of what we got. So this is just saying, okay, this wacko doctor lady said these things. I'm going to just try them once in a while, and I'm going to let myself off the hook the rest of the time because I'm a brain that didn't get this. So the key really is more about what you do before you even get into those scenarios. So an example might be, if you know that at pickup, they're cranky, which is very normal, and a lot of times you get pulled into their whiny drama, the key would be not waiting until you're in the car or walking down the street with them to try to do something. It would be taking a few minutes before you even go pick them up to get with yourself, to connect, to say, okay, how am I? What brain state am I in? Oh, I'm a little racy. Okay, take a breath. All right, look around, say 5 things I'm grateful for. Ooh, that tree. Ooh, it's a sunny day. Ooh, I love fall. Like, get your state shifted. And then when you get with them, either that will help them shift, or you won't be as triggered by where they are.
This is great. And I think this is going to help so many parents, especially when the babies are young and they're not able to communicate. Or even, I keep thinking about like partners, you know, it's so easy when everyone's exhausted. This is fantastic. So I have already.
This is humanness. This is not parenting.
No, this is human. Good. And that's why it's so juicy. So I've already alluded to the drum scenario like 3 or 4 times. I'm going to ask you to explain the drum scenario, and I will put the link on the show notes so that if anyone wants to see it. It's funny you said you didn't have kids. I'm like, oh, that must be her child's drum set, but clearly they're yours.
No, mine. Because you
played them very well.
So babies and drums were my thing as a kid, and they both got me in a place that was so visceral and primal and soulful that there was no turning back. I went toward them both and that's why I talk about the big being in the little body, because you didn't get a person, you didn't get a baby, you get a person, and their sparks of joy, you're not sure where they're going to come from. So you just want to be open to the fact that they might be into things you don't even know about. My parents were not musicians, and they were certainly not into babies. And I am this person. So I love using it for teaching, but I also love that reminder of like, be curious about who these people are, because they may be totally different than you. So what the drum thing is, I did a video that explained verbally the brain stuff. And then I was like, you know what? That's good, but I need something that's a little bit more, I don't know, creative. I wanted to give people more of an experience of it. And so I sat down at my drums, and what I realized is I can play different ways. I can play different beats or lack of beats, and it could give people a real concrete example of what it looks like from the inside of that brain by playing a certain way. So to demonstrate the human brain, I played a very organized beat, just a very steady beat. And it was like I could have a conversation with somebody if I was playing with that. And I could be creative with what I was doing, and I could slow down and speed up, and I can follow other people's rhythm and musicality if I were in that state. Okay, does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, then when I shifted into what I would represent as the limbic brain, the mammal brain, it was still connective, but it had a little more chaos to it. It was a little less coherent. It was a little less, the frequency was more wobbly. It wasn't just like a straight up, you know, smooth beat. I'm hanging out. I'm with you. There was starts and stops and little glitches, and things were just getting a little bit revved. And then when I shifted down into what I would represent as the reptile brain, that fight or flight brain, that scared brain, the stressed out brain, it was wildly chaotic. And there was no way, somebody would have to be yelling at me in order to get my full attention. And it wouldn't resonate with words. It would resonate with more intensity.
That makes a lot of sense.
So the point was to show parents the human brain is really the only brain that you can verbally talk to. And when you start to notice somebody slipping into that mammal brain, what I tell people is get low and slow, empathize and zip it. That we want to learn how to use about 3/4 less words when somebody is whiny and cranky. And that's not what most people do. Usually the kid, you say, get your shoes on, and they go, meow. And then all of a sudden you're like, here's why we have to go. And this is important. And you need to listen to me. And I'm your, and your words, words, words. And all they're hearing is Charlie Brown parents going, wah, 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 wah. And what they're not hearing is, you're safe and I'm with you and we're going to get through this, which is the thing that would turn that brain up instead of down. And then when somebody's literally falling off the cliff into that lower brain, it means they're so stressed that everything feels threatening and everything is going to evoke a reaction of either fight or flight. So what the research suggests you want to do and learn how to practice in those moments is getting yourself regulated. And then if you are physically safe and they're not going to hit your face, get a little bit below them, because what that does is it communicates, I'm not a threat to your already threatened brain. And what I mean by a threatened brain is they could just simply be growing something that we don't even see, and it just leaves them vulnerable to falling into that cranky, whiny, freaking out place more readily than we would as adults, because we've been using these pathways decades longer than them. Again, 300 years is a very new person.
Yeah. I now, looking back, I think of some of the bigger tantrums that my kids have had, especially my son, one at Disney World. And I literally can almost see it correspond with the crazy drums that no matter what I say or did, there is just crazy drums. And it just goes back to what my husband says, like their ears are not working. So this really gives some perspective and also some empathy that they need something different than what I'm doing. And if I have, I have to get myself calm. So is that what you just, I know you have a rule that you call it the 51-49 rule. Is that what you're meaning by that? Like the caregiver needs to give a little more to themselves?
Yes, exactly. It's giving 1%. And I mean, it's tongue in cheek because it's basically just a way of saying like, just give yourself one little bit more concern of your own emotional well-being and physical and spiritual well-being than you are to the others. That they are wired to know where your brain is at and they will respond accordingly. You don't get, you know, you could be human adult brain, human kid brain, and everybody's loving each other and feeling great about what they're doing. You could be human adult brain and mammal or reptile kid brain, and you have enough in you to go, oh, you're having a hard time. I need to get calm so I can help you. You can have freaking out adult brain, freaking out kid brain, and everybody's in a big old pile of mess. But what you don't get and you don't want is dysregulated, chaotic adult brain and kid figuring out how to get regulated so parent can calm down.
Yeah. So that is telling parents, and I am at fault of this, that it's really important that we take care of our needs. It's kind of like on the airplane. Like if something happens, we put our mask on first.
Right. Or else you can't help the others. And, you know, it is cliche, but it's cliche for a reason because it's true. I mean, I have a little slogan, which is self-care is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And the deeper I get into this work and just life in general, the more I realize like everybody's a reflection on some level of what I'm experiencing. So the more I do to feel good, the more I take care of myself. And that might mean having to push yourself, especially as a parent, because you can get in a mindset of like, it'll all fall apart if I step away. But the truth is, if you don't step away and get regulated or learn how to keep filling back up, everything falls apart because they're tuned into your brain state, not your words. And they feel you when you're slipping and they're going down the tubes with you.
That is so important.
So let me just give one more little bit about that, which is, I'm giving you all my stuff right now. These are my greatest hits. I love this. I haven't done this in a while. So you're like taking me out on a run, like a racehorse. This is my thing. So basically I use the analogy of your cell phone, cause everybody has them, that you can't use it unless you're charging it. And it's not an infinite charge. It's almost like become our obsession of like, how am I going to get my phone charged? So I love the analogy cause it's so clear to us that the same thing is true with humans, that we don't have this endless charge of energy, that we are, you know, we sleep and we eat and we go for runs or walks or we do yoga or whatever it is you do. And what you're doing is you're charging up your emotional battery so you can deal with life. And that battery, the minute you're not doing those things, is draining. And so that's all interesting in itself. But you add tiny humans into the mix and you have to understand that they don't have their own chargers built yet. They have to charge through you. So not only are you regulating yourself and keeping your battery charged, you're actually getting drained because they can't do it for themselves yet. It's a long process. It takes many, many years for a human to figure out how to regulate their emotional system without the use of an other. Or mother, and sometimes father, but often mother, because they came out of that person's body. You're the default of the go-to when they're stressed. It typically, not always, but mostly. So that's why this is so not just important, but critical to understand, because you getting drained and them plugging in sets off everybody's alarms.
And I see that. I see that in our house by Sunday night. I am drained and things tend to go downhill. I do believe that, you know, and I teach my students this, I'm a much better teacher than a student, that they need to take care of themselves to take care of others. And so I tell my kids every Saturday, it's my routine that I get to go to the gym and have my time and work out. And every Saturday, my son has a freak out that I'm going. So I tell him that this is how mommy takes care of herself.
Because I want
him to realize that parents need to take care of themselves. We're not just there for the kids. I think if I can get that in his head, he can respect that. I really do. I think it's vital because I see it in my family that when I am burnt out, we go down a really dark, ugly hole.
Yeah. It's messy and it's not fun and it doesn't feel good. And that's not the point of family life. The point is, you know, the point is that you're enjoying each other and that they are, you know, they would rather have less time, even if he's freaking out when you're leaving. I promise you, kids would rather have less with a regulated human brained, I'm with you parent than just a parent phoning it in and being there and saying, well, I'm devoted and I'm your martyr and now I'm going to freak out on you, you know?
I completely agree. I know we're running out of time, but I want to, if you don't mind, can we talk a little bit about slow parenting or slow family? Because I think that is something I'm trying to do more of. And I feel like we're in such a fast-paced world with so many schedules and just everything coming at us. So if you don't mind just sharing a little about that.
Yeah. So let me tell you a little bit of backstory. So my friend Bernadette and I, she's the mother of four. So I got back to Austin and we were doing classes and she was sort of the practical mother and I was the theoretical and lifelong researcher. And so we teamed up and we were doing a bunch of different classes and one of them was a new mom and baby circle. So we'd have these moms with, you know, 2 week old to 4 to 6 month old in my house. And I had this big round red rug and we'd sit around it and it was amazing. And what we would hear would be the moms saying things like, oh, there's this class and I'm worried that I'm missing out and I'm not doing enough. I mean, these were 2 week old babies and they were already feeling like somehow they were messing up. And Bernadette joked and said, man, you know, there's a slow food movement. We need a slow family movement. And she and I had this like epiphany of like, whoa. And we sat down a couple days later and we wrote out this manifesto, the Slow Family Manifesto. And it really just kind of emerged. It kind of like downloaded through us. And basically the bottom line is, it's not about doing it a certain way. It's not about being a family that doesn't do any of the extras or sits at home and is just, you know, meditating all day. It's about just three simple things: slowing down, connecting, and enjoying. And that, and finding your way into that is what it's all about. And so, you know, this really launched me into it. To me, it was a way of giving people the brain stuff without really giving it to them. Because if you slow down, connect, and enjoy, and I mean, not just connect with your others, connect with yourself first. So if you are feeling like things are going too fast and that you don't know how to make it change and you're not sure where to, you know, take stuff out or put stuff in, if you just slow yourself down and stop and pull literally the, you know, the car over and just ask yourself, like, is this working? Is this what we want? Am I doing it because it's what I feel is right for us? Or is it what I'm doing because I think that's what the society says is the right way to do it? Our whole thing is there is no right way. There's just what's right for you and yours. And that's a process of learning. And so one is just slowing down. And then two is connecting and listening. Like, listen to yourself. Listen to what you're bringing to the table of family life, because most people haven't stopped to actually think about, like, what am I doing here? Like, okay, here's these humans. If I believe that there are these big beings in this, these little bodies versus these people that I'm supposed to raise, and really I'm just having relationships with them, then isn't connecting with them and being as authentic as I can be with myself in those relationships the goal? And then the third is just trying to have fun, because ultimately that is why we're here. And ultimately that is going to be the biggest bang for your parenting buck, because you could be a parent that isn't having any fun and you can get your little people to do what you need them to do. But the minute that they start to see that there's a whole lot more fun out there and you're the cranky parent, they're going toward the other people. They're going to hightail it out of there. And so maybe you raise them, but do you have a relationship with them? And that's one of the big thrusts of my work, is how do you parent now in these early years where your role in the relationship is to guide them and help them understand what is going to give them the best experience being on this earth with other humans? How do you guide that in a way that creates adult-adult relationships that are very healthy and sustainable? Because you've got these people, I promise you, I've been with many families now, and I've watched the arc of development, and you literally have about 14 or 15 years where you are the quote-unquote parent. And then after that, you move into, it's a 10-year process plus, but it's not that much of time in the lifespan of your relationship. You move into this adult-adult relationship, and you might have 40 to 60 years. You know, we're going to live a long time. You might have 40 to 60 years where you are adult-adult with these people. And the goal is that you enjoy being together, not that they go, oh, my mom wants me to come for Christmas and I really don't want to because it's really stressful. Like, that's what we're talking about, is how do you slow down now and be in the moment of this moment and not be frantically worrying whether you're doing enough and am I giving them enough? How do you believe that you are enough and that you're giving them enough and that you're just on this journey with these people who are going to blow your mind and teach you way more than you've ever taught them? And how do you create relationships that sustain and are honest and respectful and deep?
Oh, I'm eating this up. I'm absolutely eating this up and loving it, because I think so many of us can relate to the need to slow down. And I have been working myself, and I'm sure so many other of our listeners too, on connecting. Because yeah, we're not just raising them like it's our job, although in a sense, right, you know, that's our responsibility. But we have kids, and those out there have kids for a reason. And hopefully it's not just because they're falling, you know, get married, have kids, you know.
Right.
But it's to truly enjoy the relationship.
Right.
And And I think many of us get caught in the cycle that we want the relationship, we want to enjoy it, but we've made ourselves so busy, we haven't given ourselves the time to self-care, and we get on this roller coaster. So you've laid out it so beautifully. And I personally think if people understand why we need to do things, then we tend to do them more.
I agree. Exactly. And I think the brain, you know, I mean, maybe at a different conversation, I can even weave the brain stuff a little more deeply into why the slow is a little bit, you know, that's worth thinking about. And it doesn't mean you're not doing anything. It's more of a quality of attention to self. And, you know, like I said, 51 to 49, like when I say slow down, connect, enjoy, I mean, connect with yourself more than you're even connecting with them, because the quality of connection that you'll have with them, if you take the time to do that, will feel very different both to you and them. And they don't want to phone, they don't want parents phoning it in like, all right, I'm spending time with you, but I'm not really here because I'm not really connected to myself. They would way rather have a parent that comes back from the gym and is kind of glowing because they busted their butt, and you sit down on the floor and you don't feel the need to like hurry them along through their Legos. That's as good as it gets.
Yeah. And those are the really yummy moments. And I've made, and I think I've talked to some of my friends about this, like, don't pick up the phone unless you have to.
Exactly.
Because I know when I'm spent, I can be at the playground not looking at them, but like scrolling through garbage, nothing that I really need to do, but just like entertaining myself.
Right.
So I guess that's kind of like the slowdown. Like you don't choose what you don't need to attach to.
Right. And be thoughtful. It's like, oh, I'm noticing I'm looking at my phone a lot. What's up, honey? Like, what am I, Deb, what's going on inside of me versus like,
what am I escaping?
Now I feel guilty because I should be, I'm here at the, you know, it's like the guilt is just a symptom of where you are in your brain. The guilt is your reptile brain going, you know, something doesn't feel right. Something doesn't feel right. Okay. I'm going to have to get your attention a little louder. You're a jerk. You're not doing good parenting. You know, it's like that voice, I call it the gremlin voice. I think that's what Brene Brown calls it too. It's like, those guilty thoughts and those like beating yourself up because you're not doing enough, that's a symptom of being overdone, and that needs to be cared for, not listened to or beaten down, because you won't beat it. It'll get bigger because you're not tending it. And so that's what I mean. Slow down. Like, yes.
I love it. Oh my gosh. Yeah, we could go on for hours, but I do have to go
right
now.
I know. I love it too. This is so much fun. You're
like
great.
I'm smiling and giddy. I'm like, this is so great.
Oh,
this is the kind of stuff that I just eat up. And that's why I do this podcast, and so that other people can hear it and hopefully enjoy it, because I truly believe in it. I really think the more we can tend to ourselves, the more we can be better, and not better, but present and conscious and mindful parents, which is just going to add fruitfulness to our kids. So
yeah,
I want
that's
to
it.
Thank you for the work you do. It is wonderful and so useful to all humans.
That touches me deeply. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Well, I hope we get a chance to chat again and maybe bring one of your workshops to New York.
Yes, please. I'm ready. Can you tell? I'm ready. I'm raring to go. I've been taking a bit of a sabbatical this year, and so I'm getting myself back into the groove. This was a perfect little, amuse-bouche.
Perfect.
I'm getting myself back to it. So anytime, and anybody out there, if you wanted me to come and do a workshop, I'm raring to go.
Before we sign off, do you just want to share with people where they can find your work?
Sure. So mainly it's my website, carrieconti.com. And then I have a couple of online programs if people want to go deeper. One is called On Toddlerhood, and that's a great one, a self-study for people with kids between about, you know, 1 and 4. And then I have a class, online class called Parenting Essentials, which is pretty phenomenal. It's a 12-week kind of drip course where you really learn this from the inside out. You know, it's both here's what you want to know about your people, and then here's let's dig a little deeper into you. Why does that trigger me? What are triggers? What are boundaries? What is emotional health? You know, I mean, it's a rich and not too time consuming way of shifting from old paradigm to new paradigm. And then I do a year-long program called Evolve, which I'm sort of not sure if I'm going to do next year or not. So You can look at my website and see some of the stuff I'm doing. And then you can see my travels because I sold my house in April and I just am a non-local. I'm just traveling around doing life in a way that feels really free.
Sarah Nomad. And
if you want to see that, yeah, I am a luxury nomad, I call myself, because I don't suffer. And, you know, that's another aspect of my work is really giving people inspiration and incentive to take a path less traveled, whether it's through your parenting or through your singlehood or whatever it is. You know, I mean, it's like I decided I don't need to follow anybody's prescription, but I need to be very clear on what I want. And now I'm living it and it's blissful.
Well, we will be in touch about a workshop. I'll send you an email about that soon. Well, thank you so much for your time.
You are beautiful, Deb, and I'm so happy that you reached out. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, take care. Have a great day.
All right, okay, you too.
Bye.
For my yoga teacher friends who are interested in working with the pregnant population, Prenatal Yoga Center offers an 85-hour Yoga Alliance certified program based on our three-pronged theory of prenatal yoga: asana, education, and community. Once a year, we hold our three-month immersion program in New York City. For those who cannot attend this training, Caprice and I are now traveling to different locations holding our training at hosting studios where we will spend 6 days working together, exploring and learning about prenatal yoga. This training consists of more than 50 hours working together. We also created a whole membership website with more than 20 videos corresponding directly to the manual you will receive. For more information, check out our website at prenatalyogacenter.com. Hope to work with you soon. Take care.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.